The start of the week and a sunshiny day on the radio from Riverdance the movie, and looking and feeling good during cancer treatment to finding new friends as an adult. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
People who are 25 are adults, you know, so they do have to look at the situations they're in themselves and make their own decisions around it. And we would encourage them to make better decisions.
So Look and Feel Better really helped me to reconnect with my identity at a time when I really felt it was all slipping away from me.
Friends, to me, are so necessary. They're a huge part of my life. And I think it's because friendship in itself is so platonic. It is. Nobody has to be your friend, so they're choosing to be your friend, and that in itself, it makes you feel good, I suppose.
And in the morning, standing in for Ryan, Oliver Callan was giving the nod to the start of summer.
Yeah, they finally switched on the summer at the weekend, and it was glorious and gorgeous and all those cliched words we like to use this time of the year. And so I hope you enjoyed premature sandals, I would say. There was a lot of premature sandals because there's a bit of an east wind. There's a little bite. And people in shorts and tank tops who suddenly realise around 9 o'clock or so that it's just not quite warm enough, is it, to do the late into the hours thing, into the twilight. I'm actually in a short sleeve shirt indoors for the first time this year. So my own personal summer has been declared. That's usually the start for me. It was also a big weekend for bouncy castles, I noticed, both in Dublin and in the countryside. So non-stop fun for anyone who's under 12. Very important. Unless they've eaten 3 kilos of Haribo and they fill themselves with Club Orange, then, you know, it's maybe not as fun. Because the adults, we see the bouncy castles at midday and we go, oh, I couldn't do that. You can just kind of, oh, that would be back injury now for me. You know, I'm too old for that. And then it's 6 o'clock and there's a few Pinot Grigios, and I think I could give bouncy castle a go. It just looks so bad. The bollards are bouncy. Look, I hold my shoes, Susan. All those Pilates I did are about to be paid off. It's 10 years since you did it, Susan. Just hold my shoes. Hopefully I'm wearing the good knickers because the skirt can be very revealing on the twisty slide. And then it all goes. And then it gets a bit dewy, you know, it gets wet later in the evening. And so, and of course, barbecues everywhere as well. If you love eating undercooked meat that takes 1,000 times longer than just an oven, and you love inhaling all the fumes of an open fire on a sunny day. That's a personal view on barbecues. It is not the views of Radio Television. That is just the thing. It's manly cooking, though, isn't it? It's very manly because it satisfies the masculine need to be wrestling bits of dead animals from fire and danger. So instead of ground war, we have barbecues. So, you know, we can live with that. But yes, all signs of normal life returning, and it's heartening to see it. Ructions over the street parties. We obviously have to put that there. So normal life, in other words, errant behaviour is back with a bang. And all we say actually on that, because I think this is a very good point, the writer Amy O'Connor, she reposted a message that she wrote in January. Back then, so, you know, January, remember the mood back then. And she's just saying, would love if we could start chatting about how A, outdoors is significantly safer than indoors, and B, how to facilitate safe outdoor socialising for spring summer. I can't go through another year of shaming people on South William Street. And she just says the word lol, which you posted yesterday in the reaction to the various ructions that went on again last night. So who could see any of this coming? Everyone, that's who.
Oliver Callan in the morning, and earlier on Morning Ireland, we were waking up to the aftermath of a weekend of sunshine and some crowds in urban areas around the country.
It was a gloriously sunny weekend, but with the sunshine came the crowds and large gatherings in the centres of our major cities. The CMO, Dr. Tony Houlihan, was absolutely shocked at the scenes he witnessed in Dublin city centre. That was around 8 o'clock on Saturday night. He said it was like a major open-air party. Thousands of people gathered, with many pubs serving takeaway pints, with large numbers of people sitting around drinking on the streets. The Taoiseach said government shared with the CMO those concerns, and while people are encouraged to get outdoors, the rules still apply. There were similar scenes in other cities around the country. In Galway, restrictions around the middle arch close to Claddagh were reintroduced, and there were a number of arrests in Dublin and Galway and Dublin and Cork for public order offences, and the crowds caused disruption to some businesses. Our reporter Fiacra O'Kiona spoke with two of those businesses, including Charlie Cullen, co-owner of Cullen & Co Jewellers on Castle Market Street in Dublin City.
This is the third week in a row that I've actually had to close my shop early on a Friday and Saturday. And this is due to the crowds gathering outside. They set up with picnic blankets and their takeaway drinks. They camp right outside our shops. You know, we ask them to move, but more often than not, either myself or one of my staff members are, you know, verbally abused. Yesterday, one person in the shop said, I might own the shop, but I don't own the pavement, even though they were actually literally camped outside my shop. You know, 70% of, I suppose, the sales that we achieve is from people who pass by our window and see our product in our window. It has to be stopped sooner. Like, guards need more power to stop it. You know, government needs to give clear guidelines to the guards, as, you know, they seem to only have the powers to disperse the crowds when the party's in full swing.
My name is Fiona Barnes. I work in Costello and Costello, and it's a family business that I run with my mum and my aunt. So it started off grand, you know, it was a lovely sunny day. And then at about 3 o'clock, the atmosphere just completely shifted. And I don't think I had a customer from about 3:15 until 5 o'clock when I decided to close early for the day. We've a slight ledge on the outside of our shop and people were just sitting on that, leaning up against our windows, like bringing picnic blankets, like they were at a festival. I devised a slightly sneaky plan to put up wet paint signs all around the shop. When I was closing up the shop and going home, 50 metres from the shop, I encountered 4 or 5 lads just on the side of the road in broad daylight going to the loo. It seems out of control. The place is going to turn into one big temple bar.
Then Mary Wilson spoke to Lord Mayors of Cork, Dublin and Galway. First up, Cork's Joe Kavanagh.
Crowds have been growing there over the last few weekends. You had 12 arrests for public order offences. What was it like in Cork this weekend?
It was very lively. We had a beautiful weekend weather-wise. And, you know, there was large gatherings in specific locations in the city centre. Now, obviously, with an increasing number of pubs selling takeaway drinks, that will the obvious consequence of that will be large gatherings. But there are very large gatherings of several hundred people in specific locations in the city centre. And look, that is an issue of serious concern to the Gardaí, to the health services, and also to the medical people in Cork City, because we have come so far and so many people, in fairness, are complying with the medical guidelines. You know, it is so disappointing, I suppose, that we are going down the road of we are fearful of a potential rise in numbers, and we could end up going backwards in terms of controlling the spread of this virus if we don't watch ourselves.
As you say, a lovely sunny weekend and people wanted to come out and meet their friends. Could better preparation have been made in Cork by the City Council, by An Garda Síochána, by the representatives like yourself, for crowds that really could have been predicted?
Well, to be honest with you, personal responsibility has to be taken on board here by the people who are actually gathering. I mean, the Garda, you can't have a Garda on every street corner 24/7. And now they know where the actual locations and the target locations are. And they've been out in force, in fairness, the Gardaí, and they have, you know, encouraged and, you know, and they've enforced the law in terms of, you know, public order offences. And look, the public order unit has been out and they made 12 arrests on Saturday night. But I'm really worried, to be honest with you. We have a bank holiday weekend coming up and we have a long summer ahead of us. And people are going to have to hold firm and take personal responsibility and avoid the one thing that the CMO has been saying, and all the experts who actually know what they're talking about here, is that we have to avoid gathering in large numbers because that is a potential super spreader event. It's all very well to say, oh, how can you stop people gathering in large numbers? We're asking people to please stop, take personal responsibility and stop gathering in large numbers until we get control of the spread of this virus.
Then Dublin's Lord Mayor, Hazel Chew.
I agree with Joe that people need personal responsibility in terms of making sure they social distance, making sure they take up, clear the rubbish and leave the place in a mess. But we can't tell people not to gather. The reason for that is because we've been advertising for an outdoor summer for quite a while. We've been telling people, listen, you're going to be able to enjoy your summer. So you're going to be able to be outside. And for a lot of people, they don't have front and back gardens to go be outside in. They don't. They can't invite their friends over when they don't have that space. And we need to provide that space. We need to provide safe space that's prepared and that that people can gather within groups, within the recommended guideline groups. And also there is personal responsibility there as well when they do gather in the groups. Like, this is something I've said to the council, and many have said to the council, and the council have been doing a lot of work to prepare for this, and the guards have told me that they are maxed to capacity, but it still needs more. So we still need across the board more seating, more bins, more toilet facilities. We need increase in Gardaí because there are places where Gardaí, when there is increased presence, the public and the residents and also the Gardaí have found that things are quieter or better. The example I give is Grand Canal, where we had a meeting with residents and they said the only time that things were in good order and control, even when there were many people gathering outside,
Hazel,
when there was an increased Garda unit.
Why is that not happening? We have been told for quite some time it would be an outdoor summer. Your party is at the cabinet table. Why was there not planning ahead there? You're on the city council. Why is there not planning ahead there? Where are the increased rubbish collections? Where is the increased street furniture, the additional toilets?
There has, now, to be fair on the council, there has been an increase in furniture and in rubbish collection, and there is a tender that was out for toilets, and now we have received expressions of interest for toilets that are part of pop-up businesses to that are back. The thing is, there is not enough. So, and this is something that comes from central government level, needs to fund local authorities, needs to allow them to be prepared by funding them, and also the Gardaí, Department of Justice, needs to increase funding and Gardaí to provide resources. This is something I'm going to be taking back to my cabinet colleagues to ask that there will be increase in that. Now, to be fair, both Minister Eamon Ryan and Minister Catherine Martin has provided certain funding, but perhaps we need to look across the board what we need to get better prepared, because we're not prepared.
Then Galway's Mike Cupboard was talking about gatherings around the Spanish Arch.
The gatherings in the Spanish Arch area have happened long before COVID and will happen long after. I suppose with the fine weather, it comes like night after day, there will be crowds there. Look, we've put in the temporary toilets around the city. We've tried to, I suppose, cater for the outdoor summer, as Hazel has said, but I suppose there are large numbers. We had to close off the middle arch area on instruction from the Gardaí this weekend, as you mentioned. The area, as listeners might know, it's quite dangerous for large crowds to gather. It's right on the River Corrib. There's videos from last weekend shared around where a guy fell into it, and it was on TikTok. Video shared widely where he's been pulled out by his friends. We can't have that. There's a real, real safety concern there. But like Hazel said, I think we need to prepare and have. I've said this openly before, and people disagree with that, but I think we have to prepare for these crowds gathering. And the reality is it will happen. So let's try for something in place that we can cater for a controlled space where people are going to be outdoor dining, of course, in the bars when they open, but also in the spaces where they are gathering, because the reality is it is happening. And there is huge concerns. I mean, we've put the measures in place with the extra bins and extra collections, but with the numbers gathering, it simply isn't enough, so we need to keep doing more.
Mike Cupboard, Galway City Mayor on Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson. Then later, Colleen O'Reilly, Director of City Recovery with Dublin City Council, was talking to Claire Byrne.
How long did it take to clean up those areas we were talking about on Sunday?
Yeah, well, yeah, so the guys were at it from early yesterday morning, so 4 or 5 hours went into it by 6 or 7 guys, and they got to the end of it at sometime around mid-morning yesterday. So, yeah, it took a fair amount of time. There was a fair amount of clean-up, all right.
So, listen, the decision was made, and we were talking to Owen Keegan from Dublin City Council, your colleague there, about this, closing off the Portobello Plaza, but it does seem that it just moved the problem.
Yeah, well, I suppose Portobello Plaza was a very specific set of circumstances, and I've said this on the record before. Like, that's a residential area. So, you know, the street party in inverted commas was happening around people's homes. You know, we're in a very difficult situation. Like, we're criticised for managing these unplanned mass gatherings, but we can't take actions to condone or support them as well. Like, there's two very separate issues. You know, we have toilets and bins on one point, and we also have public health guidelines. And, you know, if we provide, we feel that if we provide toilets and bins at these locations, it'll only drive more footfall and create more of an issue from a public health perspective.
Mm-hmm. So if you create the facilities, more people will come.
Well, that's, you know, that would be what we would feel would happen. That, you know, like, as it is nationally, you know, and I know you'd be talking to the minister later, we're looking at controlled and structured test events for 100, 200, 500 people in the coming months, not even in the coming weeks, you know. And that's certainly not what we saw in the city centre the weekend. So we're somewhat stuck, you know, in that we have gatherings of this size. You know, if we supply more toilets and bins, does that bring more people in? You know, do we end up with bigger public health issues? So it's a very difficult situation to manage. And I do take your previous caller Dylan's points there on board. And absolutely, I have great sympathy for the businesses that have to deal with it, as well as my colleagues in waste management who also have to, you know, clean up this on a daily basis.
There's a suggestion from a councillor who's quoted in the Times Ireland edition today saying that St Stephen's Green and Merrion Square should be open later. That would take the problem off those streets where the businesses are. Would that work?
Yeah, I suppose it goes back to, is the problem a public health issue from mass gatherings, or is the problem facilities, or is the problem the location of it? You know, I think the primary problem is it's a public health issue from a mass gathering perspective. So putting everybody into Stephen's Green and Merrion Square doesn't solve the public health issue, you know?
So what are you going to do then ahead of next weekend?
So we've meeting actually at 10:30 this morning with businesses on the street and Garda Síochán and other stakeholders and see if there's any actions we can take to improve the situation. You know, we obviously don't want to shut a city street. I think that'll have a detrimental effect for businesses on the street as well as citizens. You know, we are very keen to facilitate an outdoor summer. I think the problem is, you know, what is the definition of an outdoor summer and people's definition of an outdoor summer? And from our point of view, that's the street interventions we're putting in, the facilitation of outdoor dining, the hundreds of street furniture licenses we've been issuing over the last few weeks and working with businesses to get them out into the streets. It is very difficult for us, you know, like events like this take many months and even years to plan. And if we were to do a risk assessment, crowd control plan, suitability, location and the type of event, you know, we wouldn't be organising an event like this on South William Street. So we wouldn't be allowing it to happen anyway. So we are, as I say, in a hugely difficult situation. We're just trying to work our way through it. And if there are any actions we can take to improve the situation for businesses on the street, we will.
Government are telling us it has to be an outdoor summer. And the people who were there over the weekend were doing, you could argue, what government told them to do. Like, they weren't at house parties. They were outdoors, which is the message that they were given.
No, they definitely were doing what government told them to do, because government are telling us not to gather in groups of that size. I think the counterpoint, Claire, would be that there's hundreds of thousands of citizens of this city who engage in hundreds of public spaces throughout the city over the weekend with no issues whatsoever. They followed the public health guidelines. They took their waste with them or they put it in the bin. They planned where they went and they used the facilities and the toilets where they were. And there was no issues at all. And this was one location where issues came up.
Yeah, but if I was going into town South William Street, if I was 25 or 27, I'm not going in to meet 1,000 people. I'm probably going in to meet 3 or 4 friends.
Yeah, and I know of people, I was talking to somebody this morning whose daughter had gone into Stephen's Green and who left Stephen's Green yesterday afternoon because it was too packed. So, like, there is an amount of personal and social responsibility that people have to take on board. And people who are 25 are adults, you know, so they do have to look at the situations they're in themselves and make their own decisions around it. And we would encourage them to make better decisions.
Colleen O'Reilly, Director of City Recovery with Dublin City Council, from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ray Darcy Show, Major General Maureen O'Brien, the highest ranking female officer in the Defence Forces.
Now, last week, history was made in the Irish Defence Forces with the appointment of Maureen O'Brien to the rank of Major General. It's the second highest rank in the country, and Major General O'Brien will soon be redeployed to take up her new role as Deputy Military Advisor to the UN Under Secretary General for Peace Operations at the United Nations headquarters in New York. There's a mouthful for you. Major General O'Brien joins me now in studio. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Ray.
I can call you Maureen.
Can't you can,
I?
Of course.
Yes, yes. Congratulations, firstly, Maureen.
Gurmaga, thank you very much.
Yeah. So your military career has been a list of firsts.
Yeah, yeah. Not by design, but that's the way it turned out. Yeah, yeah.
And so, when you joined back in 1981, was that the first time there were women in
No, I did my leave of service in 77. Even at that time, there were no women in the army. Mm. So I think it was 1980, the first cadets came in. They were commissioned in 81 and there were two sets came at the same time. So I was probably the fourth intake that had women in it. The first two, we'll call them bunches, they were strictly on their own. I was the second integrated class, so females and males together. Uh-huh. Yeah, so there were six of us and 43
right. So, men. So as you went up through the ranks then,
yeah,
you were the first this and the first that and the first
no,
the other.
Sure, there were plenty of people ahead of me, but you know, I suppose as people retired, I became the first. Do you know that kind of way? Yeah.
Let's find out a little bit about you then. So you were born in Galway, was it?
Actually, I wasn't. I was born in the UK. My parents, both my parents were working over there. Now, I stayed only, well, I was told, they stayed with me there only for 3 months because I screamed and cried for the whole duration, apparently. I wanted to get home, not realising. But anyway, so just for 3 months I was there. Right. And yeah, it's been all of my life then in Galway.
Yeah.
And went to the Mercy College, Mercy School, both national and second level, and then went to UCG, as it was called then. Did a science degree and a HDIP in education. And in fact, I was teaching for just about 2 months before I got the call to the cadet school. I was teaching in the Dominican Convent in Cabra. So I said I'd take the chance, and they kindly said they'd hold the job open for a year for me. You know, right. So I'm still thinking about it.
And why the choice then of going into the cadets?
Well, around that time, you know, you applied for every job that was on the paper. And I didn't have an ambition to join the army because there were no women in the army. Yeah. So it wasn't in my horizon. But I was very physically fit. I was a sports star in UCG for a few years in
what
a row.
What did you play?
So I was an athlete. I did, 100 metres, okay, long jump,
right,
relay and volleyball as well. So I was just, I thought it would be a physical challenge, to be very honest. I was aware then that the cadets, as we call them, went to UCG for the degrees and I would have seen them. So it was in my consciousness, but not in terms of an employment.
It was a different time, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. Because you mentioned it there, it was sort of more of a job than a vocation, and it was a secure job if you got it.
Well, yeah. Well, I see. I didn't know what I was left. I didn't know anything about the rank structures. I didn't know everything. Right. But I took the leap because I figured, as I said, you know, I could try it.
Yeah.
And see what happens. Do you know? And the great thing about the army is that, you know, there's no one job the same. And I suppose as officers, we get to move around, and that has a disadvantage as well. So you move from one place to another. So you're starting from basics again and then working through that. And most appointments at that time were for about 3 years. So we went to the cadet school to train in the cadet school for 18 months. And after that, you came out as a second lieutenant, and I went down to the 4th Battalion in Cork. And that was my first posting, and you always remember your first posting and the people that were there. Yeah. Unfortunately, the 4th Battalion doesn't exist anymore, but maybe the Defence Review.
And at that stage, you were like in very low single figures when it came percentage of women in the army.
Very, and unfortunately, we're still quite low as well.
Oh,
about 7%.
I was just looking in the American army there from 2019, it was 16%.
Yeah.
So they're more than double.
Yeah, you know. Well, first of all, numbers are one thing, but it's the ranks that I think is important, whether that there's representation at higher level is important, because you can only affect change if you get into the higher ranks.
Yes.
So, yeah, it is a very small, but we're not the only forces that have a problem recruiting women. The advantage we have over some in the past is that all of the jobs in the Defence Forces are open to women, and they have been since the late 1990s.
Which isn't the case in the American military.
Well, they're all changing. They're all becoming combatant.
Right. Okay.
So you'd think then, because we have this expanse of jobs that we could go in, that females can go into, that there'd be more attraction, you know. So people might want to be a medic, people want to be an artificer, they might want to be a signals technician. And so you'd think that. So like we've spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the issues are. And I think we've a board sitting, as we always do, trying to figure out what are the impediments.
Yes. And what do you think are the impediments?
Again, it's not in people's consciousness.
Right.
But having said that, I can't understand that myself.
But say, for example, that programme that went out on RTÉ a few years ago, the recruits. Like, I don't know if you saw that, but the, you know, like it was tough. There were, it was warts and all.
Yeah.
A lot of screaming, a lot of shouting.
Yeah.
A lot
That's
of expletives.
Changed now. Yeah. A lot of that has changed. I think we learned from
as a result
them.
Of that.
Well, it was in the process of change at that time, and I was personally disappointed to see a lot of that. But you know, there is a certain sort of breaking down out of the civilian out of you for the first while, and then you have to work as a team. It's all about team building.
That involves shouting and...
It can.
Yeah.
It can. But I suppose it's the ability to take that for what it is and not let it get into you.
Major General Maureen O'Brien from The Ray D'Arcy Show. Now, Asian hornets. Like the honeybee doesn't have enough to cope with, the Asian hornet has made its way to these parts. Here's Audrey Carville from Morning Ireland.
We all know that our bee population is under threat at the moment, but a new threat to it has emerged in the shape of a particularly nasty wasp. The first live Asian hornet was discovered in Dublin last week, a single specimen and in poor condition, but the prospect of the arrival of a queen with the potential to set up a colony could be devastating for our honeybees. Killarney-based Dennis O'Sullivan is National Treasurer of the Irish Beekeepers Association, and he's been speaking to our reporter Amy Ní Riada.
At the moment I have full colonies, about 10, and then I have, I suppose, nucleuses that I make up to have to be full colonies by the end of the year, probably another 10 or 12. My own opinion is that we were probably lucky. Myself, personally, as a beekeeper, yes, you'd always be concerned that this hornet will become part of our population, I suppose, or a part of our beekeeping concerns, but hopefully it was a flash in the pan. Let's say if it was a queen bee and... let's say she's set up somewhere in Dublin, is where she came in to us. Let's say she's set up in Dublin. You could have potentially another 200 or 300 queens again out of her next year to set up their own individual colony. So, like, really, it's just one queen, but at the same time, unlike a honeybee, the hornet, similar to a wasp, would produce several queens in a season, and therefore then each of those queens in turn would produce their own colonies.
Would you notice one?
A very good question. I'm not really, I hope I would.
Dennis O'Sullivan there. Then Audrey spoke to Dr. Fidelma Butler, lecturer in UCC's School of Biology, Earth and Environmental Sciences.
Honeybees form a large part of the diet of the Asian hornet. But, you know, they also take other insects. They take other wasps and bees and flies as well. So really, you know, in addition to, I suppose, being a worry for honeybee producers, they are also a worry for pollinators in general.
They're fairly vicious, aren't they, and voracious?
They are. They are large insects with a high energy requirement. So they produce, you know, when the queen sets up her nest, they then need a lot of food, you know, to keep the young going. So they do require quite a lot of food for the young.
Could they wipe them out, potentially?
Well, here in Ireland, we're not so sure of what, you know, what is going to happen. Certainly they are widespread now around down through France. They arrived in France in 2004, first noted there, and now they are widespread through France and down into Spain and into Portugal. And there the numbers have reached, you know, very large, hundreds of thousands per, you know, square kilometre. So the beekeeping groups there are very concerned. And colonies, you know, when they have sustained attack and sustained predation, colonies become weakened, honeybee colonies become weakened, and they can collapse when predation pressure is really very heavy.
Do they like our climate, Fidelma?
Well, I suppose that is one of the things we might have going for us, despite, you know, the fine weather over the last couple of days. The temperatures here really are not that great for a species like the Asian hornet. Now, they are widespread throughout France, as I say, and they have been recorded in the UK since 2016, I think about 19 sightings. But on each occasion, you know, they have been located and removed. So whether they would establish here, we're not that, you know, we're not sure about that yet. But I guess, you know, as they are moved about on traffic and on transport, and, you know, as that increases, it is possible that there will be more sightings of them here. And who knows, maybe in a good year they might they might establish, but whether they would persist is another question.
And what do they look like? Because we're being asked to watch out for them.
Well, they are large. I mean, for a wasp, they're very wasp-like, about 2.5 centimetres. So, you know, so quite big. And they're called, you know, their Latin name is nigrithorax, and that means they're black. Their body part, the main body part, is black, and they have yellow tips to their legs. So they're quite, you know, they're quite large insects. We have one other insect here that may be mistaken. It's called a wood wasp, and they are of a similar size. And I guess you really would want to have seen the two, you know, to distinguish them. Superficially, they might look similar. Well, but the wood wasp is totally harmless.
Dr. Fidelma Butler, lecturer in UCC's School of Biological Earth and Environmental Sciences, from Morning Ireland with Orgy Carvel. Now, here's an interesting one from Today with Claire Byrne, Making Friends as an Adult. Journalist and writer Adele Coffey moved to Galway in her 30s and struggled to connect with kindred spirits.
It's not something I've ever really thought about, because I always made friends very easily, and then I found myself in a position that was kind of like the perfect storm for not making friends. I moved away from my home in Dublin and from my job. I had a baby, and so I was on maternity leave, and I moved to Galway where my husband lives. And so I was like suddenly isolated. I didn't have all of those things that, you know, you can use to make friends. Like if you're going to a new job, you get to meet a new sort of network of people and they'll introduce you to other people. I was just completely trapped in this house with this tiny child. And it was really suddenly I was alone, and all of my friends were in Dublin, and I didn't really know how to go about making friends.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you had the time to think about it, though, really, because when you know, when you have a new baby, especially when it's your first one, it's such a massive life change that there really isn't room in your head for much else.
But I think that's part of it. I think I needed my friends so much. I felt, you know, I don't know what I'm doing here. This is really difficult. And I needed, you know, people to help me and to talk to about it. And I didn't really have that. So I joined a mother and baby group, which was one of the ways of making friends, even though I had to sit through all those awful conversations of colic and reflux and all the things you think, well, this has nothing to do with me. Yeah. My life is much more interesting than this. But actually, of course, it does apply to you.
And did you make friends from that group?
Do you know, I did. I went out and tried to, I realised that I'd have to make an effort actually if I wanted to make friends. And that was something that was, I was quite resistant to, because I felt like, well, you know, I am an interesting person and people should come to me, because, you know, you just feel like, it's not something we have to do very often in adulthood. But I realized, look, if you're going to make friends, you're going to have to put yourself out there and do things you don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And so I went to that mother and baby group, and I actually still know people. And that's nearly 6 years ago now. I still see a few girls from that group.
Oh, and what about chatting to people? I was going to say chatting people up, but it is a little bit like that.
Unfortunately.
You're trying to make friends. But you were in the GP surgery and you were chatting to another young mom there.
You know, at one point I was so lonely that I think I was semi-crazy, because I would speak to anybody and I'd feel like we were having a real connection, and it was just because I was so lonely. So, you know, there are definitely sad parts to it, but I'd be offering people my number and they'd be like, that's okay, you know, you go ahead there. But, you know, there are, you can't give up hope either, and there are, you will, if that air of desperation dissipates, it is like dating, you know, people can smell the desperation off you if you're dying to meet someone. But, you know, when you kind of just relax a bit about it, you happen to meet the people and you seem more normal to them.
You know, I have to admire your determination, though, because you went to events on your own.
I did. And I never did that when I was dating. Like, I never kind of put myself out there in that way. But friends, to me, are so necessary. They're a huge part of my life, and they give me a huge sort of feeling of well-being, do you know? And I think it's because friendship in itself is so platonic. It is, nobody has to be your friend, so they're choosing to be your friend, and that in itself, it makes you feel good, I suppose. But yeah, I went to a night class in one January, and it was, you know, wasn't the best night class I've ever been to, but I met a few people there and I'm friends with those now. I went on friend dates. Now, these are nearly worse than dates themselves, in fairness.
What is that?
You know, when people, you know, you're moaning to people saying, oh, I'm so lonely, I have no friends here. And they're like, well, do you know who you'd love? You should absolutely meet so-and-so. And they set you up and you go and sit in this coffee shop, and it's like on a date, you know, two sips into your drink, you're thinking, yeah, this is going
nowhere.
No,
that's too weird. I couldn't. I don't think I could, Adele. I don't
know. I didn't think I could either. And it's really tough. And I went to book launches and I stood on my own. And it is kind of like that Morrissey lyric, you know, so you go to the club and you stand on your own and you leave on your own and you go home and you cry and you want to die. That happened. And I did go to these places on my own. But, you know, I also met people at these places. So it's important to keep your hopes high and your expectations low.
Did you ever run out of energy, though, on the whole make new friends front? Because all of that sounds tough, especially when you've got small children.
Yeah, I know. I don't. I think I'm just like unstoppably optimistic.
Well, you are. Yeah.
I'm not actually. But I think the thing is that I know from my past experience, I have great friends in Dublin who are obviously my best friends. They're still my best friends. I just don't get to see them in person so much. But what I was aware of always was the joy that friendship brought me. And friendship is there through thick and thin. Friendship is there through romantic relationships, through the breakups of those relationships, through the startup of new relationships. You know, they last a lifetime. The good ones last a lifetime. So I think that actually kept me spurred on to find friends, because there is something different about having a friend that's 10 minutes away, having a friend who you can ring and say, oh gosh, can you help me out here? You know, and yeah. You can't do that when you're living 250 miles or kilometres from your best friends. So it's important.
And Claire asked Adele about being open-minded about finding new friends.
I think what I discovered was a part of me that it's not a very... it wasn't a very pleasant part. I think I discovered that I was a bit of a snob, actually, about who my friends would be. And, you know, I'd meet people and I'd sort of think, I don't know, they're not really like me, which we all do. But then, you know, after a second or a third friend date, I realized that actually these people were really interesting. They were really nice. They were really intelligent. They had all sorts of wonderful values and traits. And I became good friends with people that I didn't expect to become friends with. And that was all through giving them a chance. And I think I gave them a chance because I didn't have that sort of network that we have, you know. And it can be hard, you know, everybody here in Galway who's grown up here, they have those networks that I have had in Dublin. And, you know, we can be quite ignorant, I think, of people trying to come into our networks. We can be very closed towards them. I think people here have been very kind to me. They've been opening up, you know, WhatsApp groups and book club groups. And, you know, when somebody new comes into your group where you're all on the WhatsApp and you're all saying things and you want to be comfortable saying the things, you know. And if somebody else comes into that group, it changes the dynamic. So I think it takes a lot of kindness for people to welcome you in. And I think that's something that I'm more aware of now. So like if I meet somebody and I realize that they've just moved here or something, I'll always give them my number and I'll always say, let's go for a coffee. Even if it's just that coffee, you know?
Yes. Some of that comes with maturity as well, though, being more accepting of other people.
Yeah. Well, I think that is something that I've learned over the last 5 years being here, is that maybe I was so comfortable and I was quite spoiled. You know, I had lived in Dublin my whole life pretty much, and I had a very strong network of friends, and I didn't ever have to kind of try or adapt or be friends with anyone that I didn't think was like me or like my group.
Adele, I love that story you tell, that fine line between being friendly and being...
stalker.
Well, I didn't want to say it. I'm glad you said it, right? Tell us about the friend when the friend had the birthday, the new friend.
Well, I can tell you about this story because it ends happily in that we are friends and I love her so much and she is now one of my best friends here. But I met this woman and I hadn't met someone so funny in years, and I actually thought I was having difficulty breathing. She was so funny. Anyway, I realized, okay, my God, I can't let this woman get away. She is going to be my new friend. I love her so much. So I took her number and I knew it was her birthday soon after. And I thought, oh, I'd love to buy her a present just to, you know, let her know that I like her. And I thought, but that's really weird. You can't do that. You're so creepy. You can't, you know, she'll never be your friend if you do that. So I thought, I know what I'll do. I will write her a poem and I'll send this to her. And I'll do it in the style of a villanelle, which is a very specific rhyming scheme. Anyway, so I did this and I sent it to her. And thankfully, she thought it was very funny and she was very appreciative. And we are now friends. But that could have backfired so badly. And it's a risk, okay? But I do feel if you meet somebody, it's like with love. If you meet somebody that you think is your type of person, you got to just go for it. Because, you know, it's so rare that we connect with people on that sort of on multiple levels that you feel like this person understands me, this person makes me laugh, I need them in my life. So go for it, and maybe don't write them a poem, but let them know you like them and want to meet them again.
There we go. That's lovely. That's Adele Coffey, journalist and author from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the live line, Joe was talking about the reviews of the new animated Riverdance movie released at the weekend.
This movie is exhaustingly bad. It's almost embarrassing. It's just the worst. It's like other terrible representations of Ireland, such as Artemis Fowl, Wild Mountain Time. And at one stage, we'll have to review her on in a sec, but Katie Ahern is in Cork. Katie, how many times have you watched Riverdance, the movie, you and your family, since it dropped on Friday?
Since we recorded it Friday?
Yeah.
Once a day.
So
it was on there when I came home a while ago again. My nephew had it on the television.
And what do you think?
I thought it was a lovely film. You know, like, I suppose when we were younger, our father was big into GA, and we were taken to Riverdance as kids. We were sent there as adults or teenagers. We were about 18. We were sent to it again. We did Irish dancing for years. And I just thought it was a lovely film, you know, like, for me, just kind of reliving my childhood a bit. And, like, it's just, I just think it was nicely made. It's beautifully shot filmed, you know, and your magical creatures are in it. I just think it's a lovely film.
And who's the...
You know, it is what it is. It's a kid's film. It's an animated film, you know.
Yeah, well, if you've watched it four times, it's a brilliant movie in your house. It's
only, it is.
You've watched it four it times is. Since Friday.
It is. Well, I suppose my nephew got treated to me showing him how to do Riverdance on Friday when it first came on. And he's seven. He's getting into hurling and things now. So he loves watching that and being, you know, the bit of hurling in it. And I think he just really, really liked it. And Mom liked it when she was watching it with us as well, his grandmother. You know, it's a nice film to relax and kind of, you know, take you out of your space, take you out of your own head for an hour or so, like, and it's beautifully shot and the storyline's lovely.
It's animation. It's like Toy Story anime. That's the quality of it, isn't it?
It's all really good. Yeah,
oh,
definitely.
Really? Okay.
Well, that's Katie then. Jo spoke to journalist Deirdre Malumbi about her review of the movie.
The sun is shining, so I'm in a great mood.
But you weren't in a great mood when you wrote this review.
Oh, no, I wasn't at all. And I wouldn't be comparing it to Toy Story anytime soon, to be honest.
Why did you write such a savage review?
I just didn't like this movie at all. I found it very cringeworthy. I found it very forced. I didn't really understand a lot of the elements of it. I understand that it is very kiddish and it is meant for that audience, but a lot of it just left me completely baffled, you know, at the standard of it. Now, I know that DreamWorks and Disney have set, like, quite a high bar when it comes to animated movies. But I mean, even you compare this to something like Cartoon Sleuth. I mean, they produced such amazing animated features recently, especially something like Wolfwalkers, which is up for the Oscar this year. And that just felt so much more authentically Irish, whereas this is very Hollywood hiddle-dee-dee Irish, if I'm honest with you. And I just find it very embarrassing to watch.
And what's wrong with the animation?
I don't necessarily have an issue with the animation. Like, it wouldn't be as high budget as something like Pixar or something like that, but it was probably fine. There were just certain scenes, certain lines in it that I found quite cringeworthy. Like, for example, the hurling scene left me kind of confused. The fact that the deer kind of creatures in it are using their antlers, which I thought made it look like Gaelic football or something.
But they were using their antlers as commands, as hurlies.
It didn't really look right, though, to me. I just thought it looked kind of weird and I couldn't get into it.
Yeah. Do you understand the magic? Sorry, not do you understand. Do you believe in the magic of Riverdance?
I do love Riverdance as a form of art, you know, and as a dance. I love dance myself. I just find this kind of weird. I find it weird to base a movie, a feature film,
on Riverdance
itself.
Yeah, is it not weird? This is the whole magic of Riverdance. Is it not weird to base one of the biggest selling shows worldwide ever on an interval act in a Eurovision Song Competition, which was a group of people Irish dancing? Is that not weird in itself?
Absolutely.
Then the movie's going to be weird. So if that's what you believe.
Yeah, I just couldn't get into it. I just thought it was really embarrassing. Like I said, it's just very Hollywood Irish hiddle-dee-dee.
so I just couldn't get into it.
Okay, well, Katie, do you want to address that? It's very Irish diddly dee.
I didn't think it was. I thought it was okay, to be honest. Like, when you compare it to a lot of other stuff out there, I thought they kind of kept it less leprechaun-ish, for want of a different word, we'll say. I didn't think it was as bad, and they used a lot of Irish actors in it, with, you know, their normal accents, we'll say. They didn't make them put
John,
on.
John Kavanagh, Aisling Bea, Brendan Gleeson. Pauly McGlynn is brilliant in it. Well, The Voice.
Yeah, and they used their regular voices as well, as opposed to putting on, you know, fake Irish accents from somewhere else. You know, so I thought that was kind of more authentic than you would find in a lot of other Hollywood-type films, where even if they have an Irish actor or actress, they're made put on a fake Irish accent. You know, so I thought they kept it more authentic that way. And I suppose, look, it is. And
well,
in the magical
world, Deirdre doesn't understand how the deer are playing hurling with their antlers. But what did you think of that scene?
We didn't think we did. It didn't really come up. My nephew loved it.
Yeah.
He was like, look at them go. Do you know, that's cool. And he thought it was class when Keegan was given his hurley and his helmet. And he
is a little boy.
Yeah, and he went down and showed his skills off, you know. Like, I suppose I took it for what it was. Kids animated show with imagination. You had these magical creatures. And, you know, that was just my opinion. And
well, that's Deirdre Malumbi there from The Live Line with Joe Duffy. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the 80th anniversary of Dublin's North Strand bombing. Dermot Ferriter, UCD Professor of Modern History, was marking the event of 1941.
Dublin in 1941 was a city of great contrasts, I suppose you could say. It always has been. There were just under 500,000 people living in Dublin at that time. And obviously there were specific wartime experiences and wartime shortages. Ireland only had 25% of its beloved tea, for example. There was hardly any petrol, bicycles galore, a huge shortage of coal. People would have been familiar as well with the glimmer men who went around checking to see that people were not using gas outside of the prescribed hours. It was an emergency. Mm-hmm. There were emergency powers being used. There are interesting parallels with some of the emergency measures being used to deal with the current crisis that we're living through. But there's also, I suppose, a very strong social divide. You know, there are 112,000 people in Dublin City living in tenements in 1941. Rob Collis, who was a doctor and a paediatrician in the National Children's Hospital, estimated 40,000 people were trying to live on sixpence a day. And then at the other extreme, you know, life went on. There was butter galore. There was steak for those who could afford it. If you went to Jammet's restaurant, you could get a duck and rum omelette if you had the money.
That's
to pay
always
for
the
it.
Way.
It's always
nothing
the way.
Nothing changes.
And I mean, there was a lively social life. You know, people went to the races in Baldoyle and the Phoenix Park. Cinema was popular, the theatres. So life went on in that sense. But there were specific regulations and shortages and difficulties that people were experiencing. And infectious diseases were a huge problem. TB and scabies and rickets. And, you know, this was the Dublin II of John Charles McQuaid, who had been appointed Archbishop of Dublin the previous year, trying to extend Catholic social services. So there are a variety of different things going on, and a familiar sight were people cycling out to the Phoenix Park to get turf. There was a fear of a fuel famine because Ireland didn't have access to the coal it would normally have imported from Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So there are specific images and practices associated with the emergency in Dublin.
So then on the night of the 30th of May, the morning of the 31st of May 1941, this bombing happened, which we're about to talk to in more detail. But it wasn't an isolated incident, was it?
No, there had been a few bombs prior to that. Nothing on that scale, of course. There had been Camp Isle in Wexford, where there was a creamery, the Shelburne Creamery, had been bombed in August 1940, and there were three women killed, three young women, including two sisters. That was a very serious event. There had been bombs dropped in Terenure and down the South Circular Road, but only buildings were damaged. Nobody had been injured. They happened in January 1941. But what had happened, of course, not far away at all, less than 100 miles up the road in Belfast, in April and May 1941, was horrific. 1,100 people were killed because of the Belfast Blitz. 53% of the housing stock of Belfast was damaged, 56,000 houses. And the morgues couldn't cope. 1,100 people died, you know. There were open public morgues in the public baths in Falls Road and Peters Hill and the George's Fruit Market. So that wasn't far away at all.
Yes, yeah.
And of course, Dublin firemen famously assisted with the rescue operation and the recovery operation during that period, some of them travelling outside on tenders all the way up to Belfast and back. So that was a reminder a couple of weeks previously of the horrors of this kind of warfare.
And that help that was given, that some of those events subscribed to the theory that maybe this was a deliberate act in 1940.
There were a variety of different theories that this was a punishment for Dublin's assistance of Belfast during its times of crisis. I think that's a bit far-fetched. There was also a suggestion that Britain had the capacity to interfere with radio beams that were guiding...
Yes, bending the signal.
Bending the signal for the German planes. That hasn't been proven definitively, but it is referred to in certain documents that were declassified way after the Second World War. But it may well have been a mistake, you know, human error. There was one of the German pilots was interviewed in 1999 and he suggested it was human error. Belfast and Dublin were obviously physically very close. And there was often a flying over Irish airspace to get to places like Manchester and Liverpool, of course, which were targets for the German bombers as well. So a variety of different theories and rumours, but none of them have been proved conclusively. It is likely that this was a result of human error.
Okay, so that night there were four bombs dropped and the last one was the most devastating.
Yeah, there were bombs dropped in Ballybock and Summerhill and the Phoenix Park, and then the big 500-pound one on North Strand, which caused absolute devastation. One particular family was wiped out, the Brown family, who were from Edenderry in County Offaly. Harry Brown had actually been out as a local defence force volunteer and he came back to the house very late at night. His whole family were wiped out, himself, his wife, his mother-in-law, his four children. You can imagine the harrowing scenes when that funeral cortege went back in June from Dublin on an open-topped lorry.
Back to Offaly.
Back to Offaly, back to Edenderry. Absolutely heartbreaking. So that was the scale of the impact that you're talking about. And when you look at the coroner's reports, you're talking about death from asphyxiation, decapitation, bodies being completely crushed, people bleeding to death, people dying of heart failure due to shock. It's a catalogue of absolute horror.
Dermot Ferriter from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning breach, Dawn was talking to Oliver Callan about finding out she had breast cancer in her 30s and becoming an ambassador for the charity Look Good, Feel Better.
I very recently finished cancer treatment. Yeah. I'm here in County Cork. I was diagnosed last summer. So last July I was diagnosed and I only finished treatment there about 6 weeks ago. So it's been an extremely long year. So Look Good, Feel Better was when I was first diagnosed. I'm a researcher and I basically read everything I could get my hands on and discovered this charity, Look Good, Feel Better. And when I saw it, I was like, yeah, that's definitely for me. So basically what it is it's a charity that provides makeup workshops and makeup and skincare kits to people that are going through cancer treatments. Yeah. And I suppose the idea of it is that it's not just about the kind of frivolous makeup thing, although there's nothing wrong with that. It's actually about self-care and learning to look after yourself and I suppose treating your body with dignity and respect at a time when it's been poked at and prodded and shot with radiation and poison chemotherapy and all of these awful things are happening. And this is a way for you to be, I suppose, be nice to your body when, you know, you're going through something so awful.
And tell us exactly what it involves, because you were going through this treatment, as you say, and it's invasive, it's really intense, and it has really, the main thing here is that it kind of has, you feel it's stripped away your identity, hasn't it?
Yeah, so that was, I kind of felt like, you know, so much of, and I mean, we're lucky to live in Ireland where there is such amazing cancer services. The treatment is incredible and we have the access to the best doctors and nurses and medicines and everything is amazing, but their focus is very much on treating it. And I suppose the impact of chemotherapy, you know, you lose your hair. All my nails lifted off. Like the hair loss was really difficult for me, and especially when I lost my eyelashes. I think I kind of handled the baldiness a bit better than when I lost my eyelashes. I kind of looked at myself in the mirror and I was like, oh, Christ, I look sick now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that was a really difficult day. So you lose fingernails, you know, your periods stop, you go into the menopause, like, you know, especially then after the surgery, you know, like I have one breast now that's smaller than the other one and I'm scarred across my chest, you know, from the port and from the surgery. And you just kind of stop recognising yourself.
Yeah.
And I mean, even, I suppose even more than that, like I work in healthcare, I'm an OT, and it was very difficult for me I'm only in my 30s, I'm quite young to get breast cancer. It was very difficult for me to lose that identity as a clinician, you know, that now I was a patient. So the whole thing left me very much kind of on very much kind of shifting sands as to my identity and who I was. And when I got in touch with Look Good, Feel Better, and I kind of got in touch because I watched the free stuff. They do the most amazing goodie bags. They're supported by loads of companies.
Okay.
You know, they donate items to this goodie bag. And I was like, I want that stuff. Like, the, you know, I was like a magpie. I was like, I want the free gear. But actually, what was amazing was the workshop that I did. So it was in the middle of COVID. So they had traditionally done face-to-face workshops, but they've really pivoted in the last year and provided everything online, which is amazing. And I did an online, it was via WhatsApp with Mary Drummond. Mary is a well-known makeup artist. She actually does makeup for Dancing with the Stars. And, you know, it was just amazing because it wasn't like a remedial, you know, makeup workshop for the cancer people. Like, you're getting a makeup lesson with a proper, amazing makeup artist, you know. And honestly, for the hour that I sat with Mary, and she gave me really good tips, you know, how to disguise the fact that I had no eyelashes, how to draw on eyebrows and stuff like that, and how to look after your skin, because cancer can be very hard on your skin. You have to be very sun safe. Things can get very, like, my eyes got very sensitive and stuff, so there were loads of really good tips. But more than that, I just forgot about cancer for an hour.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like reconnecting with my identity as a woman and as somebody who probably spends a bit too much money on makeup and skincare and things like that. You know, as I said, like, I'd like nothing more now than to burn Thomas and wander around trying stuff on and, you know, spending outrageous money on lovely things for myself. Like, I love all that kind of stuff. So Look Good, Feel Better really helped me to reconnect with my identity at a time when I really felt it was all slipping away from me.
And Breed told Oliver about the day she was diagnosed with breast cancer.
It feels unreal. I'm still not sure it all really happened, you know, that sort of way.
Yeah,
though, like,
it's very recent, yeah.
Now with extremely short hair and, you know, like, it was just the last thing that was on my radar, Oliver, to be totally honest. And I know I'm not unusual. I know plenty of people are diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, a lot of my, I've made friends who have gone through the journey with me at the same time. And, you know, it happens to lots of people, but I never thought it would happen to me. And I was, as I said, 36, married here in East Cork, and I was working for the HSC. And, you know, I'd had all the stress of trying to run a mental health service. I'm a mental health OT, so I was, you know, we were trying to keep the service going with all of the pandemic restrictions in the first wave. And I found a lump in my breast, and I would be very much of a get your health sorted kind of an outlook. So I was like, look, I'm just going to go. I'm going to make sure I get into the breast care clinic, get this checked. It'll be nothing. And then I can move on with my life. Because, you know, it is, you know, the majority of breast lumps are actually nothing. So I assumed that I would be in the majority. What's common is common, that it would be nothing.
Yes.
And went in, got the whole lot done, and to be fair to the surgeon, she wasn't a surgeon who did my surgery, it was another lady, but she rang me 2 days after I'd had the biopsy, and she was like, I'm sorry to tell you, you have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, like I mentioned shifting sands, by the way, it was like if someone pulled the rug out from under your feet.
Bree Dunn talking to Oliver Callan in the morning. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.